There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, right where He belongs, back in the middle of every conversation. But how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we enter into conversations with our neighbors and with our friends and casual acquaintances, speaking the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need another piece of our mind. What they really need is the very peace of the mind of Christ. Now, I think you are just the person to give it to them. So I invite you to connect with us online. Our website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. Let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends. Yesterday, two very rare things happened in the U.S. Senate. We talked about one of those rare things yesterday. There was actually unprecedented, 50-50 vote on a cabinet nominee. Her name is Betsy DeVos. She is now the Secretary of Education. But in order to become the Secretary of Education, Vice President Mike Pence had to break the tie vote. That's never happened before in the history of the United States. And then last night, another very unusual thing happened in the U.S. Senate. Senator Elizabeth Warren was gaveled into silence by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Subsequently, she was rebuked by a 49-43 vote of her fellow senators, prohibiting her for the remainder from speaking, during the remainder of debate on Attorney General nominee and fellow Senator Jeff Sessions. All right, so after Mitch McConnell shut down Warren's speech, her fellow senators rebuked her. It was a party line vote that prevents her from speaking any further on the question of Senator Jeff Sessions' nomination to serve as our nation's next attorney general. Now, that debate is expected to last sometime till this afternoon or this evening when the Senate will vote on his nomination. So here's what Senator McConnell said from the Senate floor. He said, "The senator has impugned the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama. I call the senator to order under the provisions of Rule 19. Now, I don't know about you. The very first thing that I thought when I heard that is, I wonder what Rule 18 is. I wonder what Rule 20 is. I wonder how many sections Rule 19 has. Well, come to find out, this is like Section 2 of Rule 19. And so I don't know if I have ever paid as close attention to cabinet nominees as I am paying this time around, because I don't think that they've ever been so fiercely contested. And that's kind of curious because certainly Republicans were not excited about the incoming Obama administration 8 years ago, but they also did not obstruct his nominees in this way. And so it is certainly making it difficult for President Trump to convene a cabinet if, in fact, the Democrats continue to obstruct the confirmation of his nominees. But specifically, let's talk about this particular situation. Senator Elizabeth Warren is not allowed to speak on the Senate floor as long as the topic is Senator Jeff Sessions. Now, that has not stopped her from taking the subject to social media, where she has been on Facebook Live and MSNBC and every other media outlet you can imagine, making the case against her fellow senator's nomination for attorney general. And so you have probably seen it. It has led the headlines everywhere today. Now, smelling blood in the water after flipping two Republican senators on the nomination of Betsy DeVos, Democrats are described across the board as re-energized. And so essentially what has happened today is that this Senator Warren rebuke on the floor of the Senate has like fanned the flames of the Democratic resistance. So for the first time since Trump took office, Democrats managed to pick off Republicans in a close roll call vote yesterday in relationship to the Secretary of Education. We've talked about that. And then they conducted this all-night debate, prior to Betsy DeVos's nomination. And so they're hinting that they may do that Again, let's talk about why Senator Warren is accused of impugning the character of her fellow Senator Jeff Sessions. It's because she was attempting to read a letter that is in relationship to something that happened in 1986, okay, when Jeff Sessions was then a candidate for a judgeship. And the charge against him was that he's a racist, okay? So let's talk about racism. Let's talk about racism. That's really what this conversation should be about. It shouldn't be about whether or not Mitch McConnell is picking on Elizabeth Warren because she's a woman, that he wouldn't have said it if it had been a man. I don't think that's true. And I don't think you can play the woman card every time it's convenient for you. Certainly yesterday, the Democrats weren't pro-woman when they were all voting against Betsy DeVos. So you can't just say, anybody that says anything ugly or nasty about a woman or to a woman, they're anti-woman. That's just ridiculous. Okay? The same thing is true here. We got to talk about racism. If we're gonna make racism the topic of conversation, then let's talk about it. And let's talk about it from a Christian worldview. What's wrong with racism? Why is it wrong? I'm going to use here an illustration that has been very impactful in my own understanding of this subject. You might recognize the names of Bill and Vonette Bright. They started a ministry that we used to be called Campus Crusade. It's now called Crew. And when you think of a couple who literally pressed the full force of their life together to advancing the cause of Christ in their generation, I don't think there's any better example than Bill and Vonette Bright. Their legacy lives on in a lot of us and lives on in their own family as well. They have a son whose name is Brad. He's married to Kathy. Kathy has a blog. Kathy's blog is called DG for Kids. That's the letter D and the letter G, the number 4, and the word kids, DG for Kids. And I'm going to read you a brief blog post that she posted there a couple of years ago. "There's nothing wrong with racism," my husband told a black pastor in Washington, D.C. They stared at each other for several uncomfortable seconds until Brad broke the silence. "There's nothing wrong with racism unless the God of the Bible actually exists." The pastor's face lit up and the power of the statement sunk in. "Oh, that's good. That's really good," he said with a smile. "The reality is," this is Kathy speaking, "apart from God, morality is a fairy tale, just like Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. When Brad does radio shows, he challenges everyone to call in, prove his statement wrong. Inevitably, atheists will call and declare they don't believe in God, but they're moral people. Brad says to them, I don't know you. You may very well adhere to moral standards. However, apart from the existence of God, you can't explain to me why I'm obligated to treat you in a moral fashion." Back to Kathy. "We want our children to grow up with a strong moral compass. We want them to be honest, hardworking, kind, generous, and extend love to all people. However, with the God of the Bible banned from the classroom and expelled from the public square, it's no wonder younger generations have a blurred sense of morality. Bringing God back into the public debate is essential, but the best thing you can do for our children's future is to teach them who God really is and why it matters. Our homes are the most powerful change agent our country has. Remember, there's nothing wrong with lying. There's nothing wrong with cheating. There's nothing wrong with racism. There's nothing wrong with drug abuse or pedophilia, abortion or rape, unless the God of the Bible exists." Now, friends, Brad Bright is the person who taught me that issues are never the issue. God is always the issue. Brad Bright also taught me the power of reframing a conversation, which moves the conversation from whatever the issue at hand is to the issue that's really at hand, which is God. The issue is not the color of another person's skin. The issue is not even the blood in our body. The issue is Jesus. The issue is God. The issue is not somebody breaks the laws and deserves justice. The issue is that we have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. The issue is always God. So I think that when we get into these conversations about whether somebody should apologize to somebody because their feelings got hurt on the floor of the Senate, because they actually got called down for breaking a rule that they should know about, and then our public debate spins around Rule 19 and whether or not a senator broke Rule 19. The issue is God. The issue is God. If the issue is race and racism, the issue is God. And so what we ultimately need to be having a conversation about is, what's wrong with racism? Nothing's wrong with racism unless the God of the Bible actually exists. Unless every human being is actually created in the image of God. If the God of the Bible doesn't actually exist, there's nothing wrong with racism. I want you to think about that for a moment. If the God of the Bible does not exist, then all men are not created equal. And none of us are endowed with inalienable rights. Because those inalienable rights are granted to us by our what? Oh, what? Creator. For those Americans who don't think that our freedoms and our life together are not dependent upon our mutual understanding of a creator God, that God actually exists, you need to go back and read the Constitution. You need to go back and read the Declaration of Independence. And then it would be really helpful if you'd go back and read the Bible. Who's going to speak that truth authentically into the conversations of the day? Who's going to say to Elizabeth Warren, look, there's nothing wrong with racism unless God actually exists. And if God actually exists, then there's a whole other conversation we have got to be having in this country. And it's not about not mistreating one another because there's a rule in the book for the senators. But that there's a rule written on human hearts that we're going to treat one another with the dignity due another person. Not because of their gender, not because of the color of their skin, but because each and every one of us is equally created in the image of God. If there is genuine racism in your heart, you need to root it out. You need to invite God by the power of the Holy Spirit to root it out. Racism is a spiritual issue. Yes, it is an issue in our culture and it's an issue in our society, but the reason it is an issue is because we have failed to make God the issue. God is always at issue. All right, I have a little good news story for you. I don't know if you've been following this immigration conversation. Probably. You've probably been following that as well. So you are well aware that, I don't know if we're supposed to be using the word ban today or not, but there's a travel ban of sorts that is a part of an executive order signed by President Donald Trump. Now that travel ban got set aside by a federal court, and then yesterday has been heard by an appellate court in San Francisco. I don't think we have a ruling on that yet, but we would certainly expect to have a ruling on that probably sometime today, certainly tomorrow. So people are still becoming citizens of the United States. People are still immigrating. People are still moving through the citizen process, towards citizenship. And so I loved this article that was posted just yesterday. And the headline is, Syrian man leads Pledge of Allegiance at citizenship event. Sophie Tureen from the Associated Press posted this yesterday. This particular dateline is Chicago. Rohi Atassi was among 117 immigrants to become the newest American citizens during a Chicago naturalization ceremony. The Syrian dentist stood out among his peers. The 29-year-old man was unexpectedly asked to lead immigrants from 37 countries in reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. Federal Judge Sarah Ellis, who oversaw Tuesday's ceremony, asked for a Syrian volunteer after delivering an impassioned speech about the difficulties immigrants face. Now, what's curious about this, or maybe interesting is a better word, Judge Sarah Ellis is also an immigrant. She is a naturalized citizen of the United States as well, her parents being from Jamaica, and she was born in Canada. So Rohi Atassi has had a green card for 10 years. He left his birthplace of Aleppo, Syria, more than 10 years ago. He said the Syrian people are already victims and all these people are running from terrorism. And during the ceremony, he was asked to be the person who would lead his new fellow citizens in the Pledge of Allegiance. So I want to talk about pledging allegiance. I want to talk about that for a moment. And I want to talk about the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. So I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. But we're not just pledging allegiance to a flag. We're pledging allegiance to the republic for which it stands. What republic is that? One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Do you pledge allegiance not just to the flag of the United States of America, but do you pledge allegiance to the republic for which it stands? Do you pledge allegiance to one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all? Let me ask you, when was the last time you actually stood, placed your hand over your heart, and pledged allegiance? I want you to think about that for a moment. When's the last time you did that? Now, if you're a member of a Rotary Club, then I know it was like Thursday at lunch. All right. If you are a child who goes to a very particular kind of school, you're saying to yourself, well, I did that this morning because that's what we do every morning. But this might surprise you. That doesn't happen every morning in every school across America. In fact, it happens in fewer and fewer schools every year. If you're a Boy Scout, if you're a Girl Scout, maybe you pledge allegiance at those meetings. As Christians, it's important for us to recognize our dual citizenship, to recognize that our first allegiance is to Christ, our first allegiance is to the kingdom of God. But we are also citizens of a nation, of a people here on earth. So, when's the last time you pledged allegiance? When's the last time you pledged allegiance to Christ and his kingdom? Did you know there's a pledge to the Christian flag? I looked this up. There's actually two versions of it. In 1908, the original version reads, I pledge allegiance to the Christian flag and to the Savior for whose kingdom it stands, one brotherhood, uniting all mankind in service and love. Now, some years later, evangelicals got a hold of that and thought to themselves, you know, that's not only universalistic. People who are concerned about both exclusivity and inclusivity, they don't actually like the pledge to the Christian flag, in part because the 1908 version is sexist, one brotherhood, uniting all mankind. Nobody likes that language anymore. But on the flip side, it was also universalistic, as if Christ saved everyone. So the evangelicals got together with maybe those who didn't like the brotherhood, mankind language, and they came up with this. So this one is probably the one you'll find most frequently in vacation Bible schools around the country these days. I pledge allegiance to the Christian flag and to the Savior for whose kingdom it stands. One Savior, crucified, risen, and coming again with life and liberty to all who believe. You know, there's ceremony that's important, and there's repetition that's important in terms of learning, and they're powerful. I mentioned Rotary just a minute ago. Rotary International, you know, I just give a shout out to them. I was a member of Rotary for 5 or 6 years when I lived in Rabun County, Georgia. And every week, Thursday, lunch, that's why I mentioned that. Your Rotary Club probably meets at a different time on a different day. But anyway, every week without fail, part of our routine was to pledge allegiance to the flag. And then we recited the Rotary four-way test. Is it the truth? Is it fair to all concerned? Will it build goodwill and better friendships? Will it be beneficial to all concerned? You know, I don't know about you, but I feel like Christians today could use an opportunity to regularly pledge allegiance and regularly articulate a four-way test of the faith. I don't know exactly what that four-way test would be. This one actually isn't so bad. Is it the truth? Like, that's a good question for us to be asking today. We want to be people who not only are recipients of the truth, but we are people who only speak the truth. And yes, we want to speak the truth in love, but we don't want to be passing along falsehood of any kind. Is it fair to all concerned? That's a good question to ask ourselves. Will it build goodwill and better friendships? Will it be beneficial to all concerned? I realize this is the Rotary four-way test, but my concern is this. A lot of churches are not reciting the Lord's Prayer. They're not reciting the Apostles' Creed. Why? Because they don't want to become formulaic. They don't want to find themselves just repeating something in rote repetition. And I totally understand that. But I also recognize that ceremony and ritual and repetition are part of the way that we become a we. And unless we can stand up and say what we believe, unless we can stand up and say what we bear allegiance to, pledge allegiance to, then there's not much of a we left. There's an individualistic faith, and I go in and I individually worship and I have an individual relationship with God, but where's the we in that? This is my concern today. My concern today is that we have lost a sense of we. Not much we-ness in our worship. All right. I am not advocating repetition for the sake of rote repetition. I am advocating repetition for the sake of reminding ourselves and reminding one another of who we are, what we believe, how then we shall live. What do we believe? To whom and to what do we pledge allegiance and why? Do we have a way of articulating even a four-way test of the faith? I don't know. But it's a question that I think is worth lifting up. All right, I had this conversation just before we went on the air. The political rancor today is I don't know that it's ever been, well, certainly not in my lifetime, ever more heated, more ugly, more partisan, more nasty. There's all kinds of politics blogs out there. I pulled this off of Axios. This is called Sorry, American Politics Will Get Worse. For anybody that was looking for hope that things were going to get better, actually, those people who are looking at all of this actually think it's going to get worse. It's going to keep getting worse. Why? Well, it's going to keep getting worse in part because the institutional defenders of normalcy are gone. Basically, a decline of institutional guardrails is one of the ways that it's articulated. National political parties really are not as powerful right now as social media, and social media is a pretty ugly place to be right now. The extremes are leading the conversation. The extremes are dominating. The centrists, anybody that would be willing to compromise, man, they are being shucked aside for sure. Restless activists are the ones with the power today. And that means that the flames are fanned in always the worst direction, which means fake news has a way of being promoted and shared more quickly. The conversation escalates and then it devolves. People increasingly do not trust real news and real news outlets. And then when people get pulled into it, there aren't any institutional sort of guards or guardians who are able to step forward and influence culture in a positive direction, to influence the conversation in a way that would, I would say, honor Jesus, but even just honor our own shared humanity. Why is that? Well, listen to this walk-off sentence. Without the calming influencers in politics, now the calming influencers would be historically political parties, big business, politicians who were centrist and interested in working across the aisle. Without these calming influencers in politics, media, and business, there are no checks on the forces reshaping the national discourse. What's missing from that sentence? In terms of the calming influencers in politics, media, and business, the calming influences in culture, the influencers that are reshaping the national discourse. Anybody notice anything that's missing? Well, how about the church? See, I feel like part of our problem today is we don't have any public theologians who are not only worthy of our trust and admiration, but who are out there mixing it up in the political arena. We don't have an Abraham Kuyper. I talked about him yesterday. If you missed that, go back and listen to the podcast at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We don't have an Abraham Kuyper. We don't have a Martin Luther King Jr. We don't have a person leading a moral conversation in this country right now and mixing it up with politicians to say, this is not okay. This is not who we were created or called to be. All right, friends. After the break, we're going to be joined by David Drucker. He is a journalist who follows politics in DC. He's going to talk with us about Trump. This is The Reconnect. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Reconnect with your host, Carmen LaBurge. Now, back to Carmen.
Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we are talking about what people are talking about, trying to equip you to be the ambassadors of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. If you'd like some help with that, connect with us online. Our website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. One of the folks I follow on Twitter and enjoy reading is David Drucker. He's a senior correspondent for the Washington Examiner. He covers Capitol Hill, the campaigns, political trends, pretty much all things Washington. Previously reported for CQ Roll Call and the Los Angeles Daily News, he's the host of the Examining Politics podcast, and you can follow him on Twitter at David M. Drucker. David, welcome back to The Reconnect.
Good to be here. Thank you.
All right. So I think it's safe to say President Trump has a very unusual relationship with the media. So what are sort of the short-term, long-term effects of a president who consistently relates to the media in what I'll call hostile ways and even suggest that you guys are dishonest?
Well, I guess we're going to find out, Carmen. I mean, I think, you know, to some degree, it's going to serve him well politically. Most people don't like us. Me being a part of the media, they don't trust us. They think we've lost a lot of credibility, and they don't think that we like them too much. And that's on the right. Even on the left, and there's a lot of skepticism about how the media does its job, just for different reasons. So I don't think hating the media or being critical of the media is going to hurt him necessarily. From a political standpoint, I do think that over time it's possible that if his policies don't deliver the way he has said they will, and then voters become disenchanted with him, and it's early in his presidency, so this could go really well, or it could go really poorly, or it could be somewhere in the middle, it could be just one more reason why people get exhausted with him, the constant fighting, the constant bickering. And, you know, at some point people might say, again, if they're not happy with his job performance, why don't you stop complaining about the media and just do your job? So that's very possible. So I think it just sort of depends on how his presidency unfolds and how people feel about it. Usually when voters are happy with a politician's performance, they put up with and overlook a lot.
So I think the word fatigue was one I heard earlier today from someone. They're already feeling fatigued by sort of the political rancor and I've told them I don't think it's going away. I actually think that the political rancor part of this is probably going to get worse. Tell us, how do you cover a president like Donald Trump, who uses Twitter so freely, has apparently unreported after-hours conversations with all kinds of folks, and we don't know what all that's about, seems unconcerned about the fallout of what he says. How do you cover a person like this?
Well, my rule is just to cover him normally. It can be a lot more work at times. You know, I was just having a conversation here in the newsroom with somebody. Usually with presidents, there's what this thing the White House calls the lid. And they'll say, you know, basically it's 9 p.m. or 8 p.m. or whenever. And they'll say, there's a lid. Don't expect anything more from the president tonight or today. And you don't have to worry about it. With Trump, you just never know when he's going to tweet and start making policy or lobbying a tax at you know, some country or another. And I'm not putting a value judgment on it. I'm just saying from the perspective of covering him, it's just more involved. But I think the best way to cover him is just to cover him like you cover any other politician. You report on what they say. You are analytically critical and skeptical, but you're fair and firm, and you don't take things out of context if you can help it. And you just, you know, try and give people information. I think one of the things that is a little bit more difficult is the president says a lot of things that are, quite frankly, just hard to understand. And I don't mean because of any – I'm not even describing fault to him per se or saying, you know, it's somehow he's lacking in the ability to communicate. What I'm saying is he will sometimes just say things. My favorite example is a couple of weeks ago he threatened Mexico with a special tariff, and I spent 40 minutes on the phone trying to figure out what he meant. And I finally figured out that he wasn't really threatening Mexico with anything that wasn't in the House Republican tax proposal if it passes, and that Mexico will actually have to deal with whether or not they pay for the wall or not. But that's the kind of thing in the Trump era that I've been having to do is, you know, trying to be very careful about paying attention to what he says and then figuring out what it means. Sometimes that takes a lot more time and effort than it has for other politicians that I've covered.
Well, and I think President Obama was so deliberate in his speech and in his speech pattern and in the content of what he said. He was incredibly deliberate. And so that is completely different than the pace and the content and the kind of language that this president uses as well. I think that there's a fluency challenge, right? So he doesn't even speak political language. He just speaks whatever language comes to him. And so I think that for those of us who are consumers of information, and you know, we are taking in what the media is giving us, what journalists like you are reporting, and then we're seeking to understand it as well. So we certainly appreciate the role that you play in providing that analysis and a layer of skepticism in providing us the information that we need to understand what the president is saying, and then going through that extra step of actually, well, this is what he said, and this is what we think that means. Okay, so President Trump, I feel like he has a very different relationship with some religious media outlets, some organizations who we maybe haven't seen called on in ways that they're called on now, and see him use like CBN as an example in ways that previous administrations have not maybe shared with those kinds of media outlets. Is that approach, just kind of tell us, how's that received by journalists in D.C. who maybe haven't viewed religious media outlets as on par with their own outlets?
Hard to say, just because I haven't talked to my colleagues about that. I mean, look, there's a certain pecking order in journalism in Washington that exists anyway. And especially if you cover the White House, there's always been a pecking order. And so I think anything that gets outside of that, it probably rankles some people. Look, I'm a competitive journalist. When I'm on Capitol Hill, which is where I do most of my field reporting, if you will, and we're at a, you know, the weekly press conference that one of the political leaders holds, if somebody from out of left field, or right field for that matter, all of a sudden butts into the question, I mean, the competitor in me is kind of like, I never see you here. Who are you? Do you even know what you're talking about? What are you going to do with this information? You're taking up valuable time. I mean, I think that way. I don't say anything. So, you know, there's human nature involved here, and then there's, you know, are people actually rankled by this? Maybe. I'm not sure. I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with politicians spreading around their questions. I don't think that as journalists for a particular outlet or on a particular beat, we're owed anything. You know, I do think it's important, you know, when journalists take valuable time to ask questions, just use it wisely, have a purpose, because all of us are there and we've got a job to do. So it may bother some people. It doesn't bother me. I the only thing that I care about as a journalist is I don't think that we need to beat up on every politician we talk to every time we talk to them. I certainly don't. But I do think you're supposed to ask questions that are fair but also a little tough. Make the administration, make the speaker's office, you know, deal with their challenges, and don't, you know, we're not there to pat them on the back. We're not there to make stuff up, but we're not there to pat them on the back. And so the only time I think I ever get annoyed, really, and I think most of us get really annoyed, is if somebody's there and they're like sort of like a friendly and they're patting them on the back. And that's what people talk about.
Yeah, I think that the whole Skype thing has been interesting. It's been curious to those of us who are completely outside of that circle and outside of the Beltway, you know, to recognize that there's this, and I know this is the White House, but that there are this group of people who are there all the time, and they are intensely focused on this. And then to have these folks who are, you know, their issues are related to Nebraska, or their issues are really just really kind of far outside the Beltway when they ask questions. And so I kind of just wondered how that feels. So thank you for sharing your personal insights. Hey, folks, we're talking with David Drucker, senior correspondent for the Washington Examiner, covers Capitol Hill and all kinds of things political. You can follow him on Twitter at David M. Drucker, and you can hear his podcast, the Examining Politics podcast. David, before I let you go, and thank you for being so gracious with your time, let's just talk about the sense that the media, the news media, has in some ways become the story leading up to the election, after the election, with the whole conversation surrounding fake news and whether or not some news outlets are fake news outlets. Can you just talk about from the inside of journalism? You know, journalism professionals, we recognize that you guys, I mean, take great pride in your work and in communicating stories that contain truthful information. What has this experience been like?
Well, I think for some of us, it's been a little uncomfortable. We never want to be the story, but part of it, I think, is not our fault. And look, I'm a big critic of my own profession. One of the reasons I went into it is because I was critical of it and thought maybe I could do it better. Who knows? But you know, when you're constantly called out, and in some cases by name personally, by major candidates for president or then the president of the United States, it's hard not to become a part of the story. I think we'd all prefer to tell a story and not become the story. We all want to get read. We all want to make news, and we all want our stuff to be noticed. I mean, that's why we do this. We don't do it just to write for ourselves. But we definitely look. It's uncomfortable for me whenever I, you know, have been sort of on the edge of becoming a part of a story. It's never. It's just not what we're supposed to be doing. So we don't like it. But in some cases, I think Republicans in particular, which is fine, have found it so fruitful politically to fight with us that in some cases we've become the story because they've cast so much attention on us. And that I don't really know what to do about that other than, I just try and do my job regardless. Most of my colleagues, that's what they try and do as well. There is bias that exists. Republicans usually get the brunt of that. But usually that's about worldview, where most members of the media have a certain worldview and not an actual attempt to, you know, fix an election or something like that. But, you know, having said that, the less they talk about us, the less we're the story. And so if that's a problem, then just talk to us for our stories and stop putting a spotlight on the work we do, even if you don't like it.
All right. We will take that as your advisement to us as well. David, thank you so much for being with us today on The Reconnect. Thank you for your work. Folks, you can follow him on Twitter at David M. Drucker.
Thank you, Carmen.
Thanks. All right, folks. I think that we need to be supportive of those journalists who really are trying to just get the story out. And so encourage you, if you've got somebody who you read and you really value what they're writing, I just feel like you should let them know. So there's a myriad of ways in which you can reach out and encourage people. And so instead of just being a person who always comments negatively on something or is always throwing flames at somebody, hey, maybe today you could actually encourage someone in their vocation. I am very aware that people go into journalism for good reasons, right? David Drucker just shared with us, you know, one of the reasons that he went into it is because, well, he thought maybe he could do it better than it was being done. When you see people doing journalism well and reporting on things accurately, and I'm not saying that they need to be reporting on it in a way that, you know, their bias matches up with your bias. What I'm encouraging you to do is be a person who encourages instead of always discouraging. So I think that when we talk about the good news of the gospel, we're talking about news. And we would not be recipients of the good news of the gospel if there weren't, you know, sort of these journalists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Peter and James and other writers of the New Testament who actually reported to us what took place, who was there, what happened. And so I'm going to encourage you to be an encourager of people who are reporting in the media today. They don't always get it right, you know, neither do I. So there you go. All right, so you can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com if you've got a comment to share. Facebook and Twitter are the best places to do that because I get those almost immediately. I am on Twitter at Carmen LaBerge. All right, folks, it's time to go below the fold. This is the point in the show where we like to lift up stories and make connections that are designed to, well, help us start or engage in conversations may not initially appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles could change not only the conversation, but the course of another person's thinking and then ultimately their living. If I can get you to think about what you're thinking about. And then, If I can get you to think about what you're thinking about a little differently, I have actually changed your mind. I want you to think about that for a second. If I can get you to think about what you're thinking about, and then I can get you to think about what you're thinking about a little differently, well, I've actually been used to influence the way you think or to change your mind. Okay, that is what our agency is supposed to be like in the world. As ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven, as agents of grace, our agency is to help people change their mind and ultimately to change their mindset. All right, I got a worldview conversation to have with you. David Drucker brought up the concept of worldview. Here's a worldview headline for you. Hans Rosling, who dreamed of a fact-based worldview, passes away. Now, Hans Rosling may not be somebody you have ever even heard of, or if you have heard of him, you're not really sure why or in what context. He's 68 years old. Tragically, he died of pancreatic cancer on Tuesday. He is a Swede, and he's a statistician. Okay, they would describe him this way: Swedish physician, epidemiologist, and statistician or statistics expert. And you say to yourself, okay, why are we talking about him? Okay, we're talking about him because his obituary, first of all, is international news, which is kind of curious because he's probably not a guy whose name is, you know, everyday language to us or that well known. But he dreamed of what is described as a fact-based worldview. Now, what is a fact-based worldview? And I would say Christianity is a fact-based worldview, right? It's the truth. If you have a worldview that does not align with the truth, that doesn't align with reality, then it's not fact-based. And that's what Hans Rosling was trying to get people to embrace. He was trying to get people to embrace a fact-based worldview. Now, here is what his family has said. Hans is no longer alive, but he will always be with us. And his dream of a fact-based worldview, we will never let die. Here's the tragedy of this story. Because he was so fixated on observable facts, he missed the reality of a life beyond this life. He was so obsessed with being sure that people could actually physically see the facts that he absolutely failed to see the unseen, which is the fact of eternity and eternal life. So I want to talk about him from a very, very positive frame in terms of what he did, because Rosling believed that if he could simply help people see the facts, that people would then believe them. So if you are a person like me who appreciates the visual representation of statistical information, like, I am not a person who does well with just a list of numbers, but if you plot it on a diagram and you make big circles for the places where the numbers are big and little circles for the places where there's not very many, or you make a big stack of blocks and a little stack of blocks, you actually help me see the piece of the pie is bigger. That's his thing. That's the gift he gave the world, the visual representation of facts. So if you Google him, you can actually watch these videos of all of these really cool visual representation of facts, because he wanted people to physically see the facts, believing that if people could see it, they would believe it. He learned along the way that people have the capacity to rationalize away and therefore deny fact-based truth. He found out that even if you presented it to them visually in ways that they could readily see and understand, they could still deny it through rationalization. Well, how is that possible? How is it possible that people could rationalize away something that you actually showed them? I'm sure God asks himself that question every day. Look, I showed them. I've told them. How could they deny the truth of it? Show and tell is not enough for some people. Jesus tried. I want you to think about that. That's actually the reality of the incarnation. Jesus showed up. Jesus showed up to show and tell the truth about God's existence. Jesus showed up to show and tell the truth about God's character and God's will. Jesus literally put God on display. Fact-based worldview. He put God on display, and people still rejected him. People still rejected the truth that was right in front of them. That is basically the definition of delusion. If I present the facts to you and you deny the truth of it, that is delusion. And one of the things that Hans Rosling experienced was that even when you showed people the facts, even when you showed them the truth, there were a lot of people who just denied it. And that's delusion. Scientists deal with delusion. Epidemiologists deal with delusion. Physicians deal with delusion. Politicians deal with delusion. And you and I deal with delusion. Why is that? Because seeing is not believing. It's just not. Just because we see it does not mean we're going to believe it. Do you remember Thomas? Thomas called Didymus, one of the 12? Well, he was not with the disciples when Jesus appeared to them following the resurrection. The other disciples told him, fact-based worldview, Thomas, we have seen the Lord. Thomas said to them, unless I see the nail holes, the nail marks in his hands, unless I actually, this is, you know, he's the empirical example here. He wants empirical evidence. He wants to see it. He wants to touch it. Unless I put my finger where the nails were, unless I put my hand in his side, I will not believe it. A week later, now that's kind of curious, right? Jesus let Thomas wander around and wonder for a week while the other disciples who had seen the Lord were out testifying to other people, and other people were believing them without seeing. Thomas, holding fast to his empirical desire, held out. And a week later, the disciples were in the house together. If you're wondering where this is from, this is chronicled for us in the 20th chapter of the Gospel according to John. So a week after Easter, the disciples are back together. Thomas is with them this time. And the doors were locked, and Jesus came and stood among them. And he said, "Peace be with you." And then he looked at Thomas and he said, "Thomas, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out. Put your hand in my side. Stop doubting and believe." And Thomas then makes this confessional statement, which is, "My Lord and my God." And then Jesus tells them, "Because you have seen me, you have believed." Fact-based worldview. "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. What and why do you believe what you believe? Do you believe what you've seen? Do you only believe what you've seen? Do you believe what you've never seen? Do you believe that which you have seen evidence of? I have certainly seen evidence of the Lord. I have seen evidence of grace. I have seen evidence of mercy. I have seen evidence of God's holiness. But I haven't yet seen God. What does it mean to have eyes of faith that see what others don't see? Our job is to then show them. You and I have the privilege of becoming living demonstrations of grace and truth. You and I can be the living demonstrations of the gospel, becoming the kind of visual aids that Hans Rosling understood people needed. All right, friends, that's all we got time for today. See you back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.